No dreadful jangling prolongation of soul-disturbing discords, no series of unrelated notes and intervals denominated a melody, no fantastic disposition of instrumental playing that has not the advantage or quality of being really amusing nor the inherent skill of being clever. None of these barbarities is allowed to pose as music in these realms. When we come to view the earth as a whole, without delving too deeply into such particular subjects as the arts, we can see how really ugly the earth can be. In nothing. More so than in your very style of architecture is this so readily apparent. In this respect there has been retrogression. It might be said in extenuation that the needs of the case have had an adverse influence upon domestic architecture. Populations have increased enormously beyond what they were so many hundreds of years ago. Consequently, living space has become more precious so that every available inch of it must be used to the greatest advantage. Hence the long dreary rows of ugly private dwellings, each jammed tight and close upon its neighbor, each mathematically similar, uninspiring, and uninspired, colorless, gray, or just plain dirty. It is scarcely wonderful when an inhabitant of one of those obnoxious dwellings comes to these realms that he, or she, casting his eyes about him upon the glories and delights that surround him, should believe himself to have attained to the highest heaven of all. The transition from ugliness to pure beauty is violent in such cases, but the violence is enjoyed to the full. Now, we realize perfectly all your difficulties upon earth, not the least of them that of space. But what attempt has been made really to overcome them? Precious little that is obvious. Your properly constituted authority. Being something of a movable feast, you are never to know just exactly what you will get next. There are too many different opinions among them and not enough unity of purpose based upon ideas that will reveal in their achievement a perfect compound and balance of usefulness and beauty. The art of tectonics. It is an art that has been almost lost. In your present day's utility so often connotes bareness, frigid severity, unrelieved by a trace of color. These, when added together, do not produce a total sum of beauty. Beauty of form has been sacrificed to strict utility. Individual craftsmanship has given way to production by the million. That has certain advantages because by it so many can partake of improvements, who would otherwise be debarred by expense. If it brings more brightness into more homes, then so much the better. But there is this to be said. My informants of other days, who are also dwellers in these realms, tell me that in their day they combined usefulness and beauty in their work as a matter of course. The rule then was beautify somehow wherever possible. A small ornament tastefully executed was better than none at all. Improvements, they were advised, should always be considered in terms of what was pleasing to the eye, and all necessities should be similarly regarded. The craftsman, therefore, went upon his way as an individual who took a personal delight in his work because he knew that he would be identified with the result and not treated like a machine. Material advancement on earth has meant the great building up of commerce, which is the chief concern of the towns and cities. It would be superfluous for me to recount to you what you will see in them. When you come to view our great cities of the spirit world, you will see the no shops, no printed signs, none of the familiar indications of commerce, for of commerce we have none. Nor do we have such monsters of ugliness, factories. To build a beautiful earth in those regions that require it most should be the aim of those in whose hands is the government of the incarnate. I have spoken to you of the way in which builders of olden time combined usefulness with beauty, and that in overcoming faults or defects they always were mindful of what was attractive to the eye. In my old house on earth there was a good deal of panelling. It was very lovely, and brought me much joy. But it also served a most useful purpose. It helped to make the apartments warm. There was a time on earth when men began to build their dwellings a little more solidly by making them of stone. But they found in winter that the stone was cold and chilled the rooms. Even though doors and windows were adequately sealed, yet there still persisted cold drafts, whose point of emergence seemed a mystery. The cold stone wall was the culprit. by the simple device of hanging material upon the walls and thus confining the cold surface, the unpleasant drafts were reduced. In the larger houses, tapestries were freely introduced, just as I have tapestries in my home here, though for a very different reason. The art of the weaver was requisitioned to provide what was needful, and the fine arts were combined with strict utility. In some houses, wood paneling was used to cover the walls. While it was excellent in itself, yet the carver was set to work to spread his art upon its surface, with what results most of you will be acquainted. It may have made the rooms somewhat dark after the sun had set, but what matter? Folk retired to their beds earlier in those days. With my house on earth, I had the advantage of modern invention, and with its aid I still further improved upon the splendid work of those ancient artificers, for I was able to light the chambers as strongly as I pleased, and so suffered no inconvenience from the darkness of the wood. I reaped enormous benefit to my personal comfort, both of body and mind, for the chill drafts were appreciably reduced, and to the eye ever delighted in the luster of their ancient panelling. This is a small incident, of course, I recount it solely for your interest, and to point to the fact that through the ages the earth has never been without its inspired help in every shape and form, even to helping in making your earthly domicile a more fitting and comfortable place. To point, also, to the fact that all material advantages are not upon the exact lines which those of the highest realms had urged. The combination of the beautiful with what is useful has generally departed, and, indeed, often the useful is missing as well. Even after usefulness has no further application, there is no reason why the beautiful should be abandoned in favor of the ugly. With such lovely things to choose from in this spirit world, yet I elected to retain the paneling upon my walls, simply because it is delightful. We have no chill drafts to combat here, but the woodwork, that is, the spirit world equivalent of woodwork, loses none of its beauty on that account. The paneling is serving a most useful purpose, and no one would wish to have it removed. Next headline is Service. At the commencement of the catechism, which I had occasion to use when I was incarnate, the answer to the question as to why God made us is that He did so to know Him, love Him, and serve Him in this world, and to be happy with Him forever in the next. Which is all very good, as far as it goes. But it omits one very important point. The answer is explicit in declaring that we must serve God on earth, but it makes no mention of serving Him afterwards in the spirit world. Such service would appear to be confined to the earth, which would point to a life spent in complete idleness in the hereafter. Many would say that the life after death will be devoted to concentrated efforts of praise and prayer until weariness from this pursuit finally sets in. It is to be presumed, whereupon, it must be supposed further, that there remains nothing whatever to do but be happy, though how the latter is to be achieved no one could possibly know or even try to guess. We should be happy, and that was enough. Doubtless some provision had been made that would ensure our happiness. Perhaps the mere state of being holy would itself be the highest form of felicity, or to be in the permanent company of angels and saints would afford us unalloyed joy, especially if one engaged in pleasant theological or pious discourse upon lines, of course, in strict keeping with the true church to which we formerly belonged upon earth. This would raise extremely knotty problems because of the difficulty of ascertaining which of the hundreds of churches is the true one beyond peradventure. Or perhaps there would be a blending of them all, which in turn might raise further troubles, for if none of the churches can agree in their various doctrines on earth, is it to be expected that they will do so in heaven? The man who is accustomed to elaborate ritual and complicated doctrines might be revolted to think that heaven should also harbor a member of a church which regarded all ritual as rank superstition and complicated doctrines as devilish. Between these two widely divergent types of religious thought and practice, there are countless other homemade religions, each claiming some portion of heaven as its own, if not the whole of it, and by something more than implication, ruthlessly debarring the members of all other denominations from even a small corner of the celestial realms. all of which, you will agree, makes things very awkward and difficult. As the Catechism makes no positive mention of anything to do in heaven, it seems impossible to think otherwise than that some very major complications must inevitably arise. It would not be proper to suggest that the devil always finds something for idle hands to do, for, after all, we are discussing heaven. How near is that simple Catechism answer to the truth, and how remotely far? For no one could quarrel with the first part of the answer as it deals with the earth world. It is when it ventures upon the second part that it gets all abroad and everywhere but in the right spot. Here is a simple question which might well be placed in the Catechism: how is God best served by man? And here, too, is the answer in Catechism style: God is best served by man when man serves his fellows. The keynote of the spirit world, my friends, if I may so express it, is service. By service, I do not mean servitude. For that is the last word to be applied to our service in these lands. Rather is it a word never to be applied. Service is a term that covers an immensity of activities, occupations, endeavors and achievements. By service, we gain those many rewards which are here for the gaining. By it we gain our spiritual progression. Service is not comprised under any one heading. It is here and everywhere. There is no good thing we can do but that it will bring some good to someone. Often have I spoken to you of the work in these realms, and even attempted to give you some small account of our occupations and recreations. Work with us means service, not toil. It brings tangible results. We cannot buy service nor are we paid for it. We have no money nor its equivalent. Now it is all very well for you, I hear you exclaim, you are not living in a world where, without money or something to take its place, you cannot survive. You do not have to work for a living, and by all accounts if you did nothing whatever, but remained utterly idle, you would not starve or go in rags. Perfectly true, my friends. You are living in a material world, so are we, if it comes to that. By material, of course, is meant a solid sort of world like the earth. Firm to the touch and real, above all things real. Precisely, that is just what our world of the spirit is, solid and real. Material, in fact, if anything can be. But we need not argue over terms. Our world is as yet intangible to you, in the same way as yours is now to us, for we can comfortably walk through the thickest wall that was ever constructed on earth as though it had no existence, which it has not for us, beyond a vague mistiness. Relatively, we are in a similar position to each other. Strange, is it not? You are vapory to us, but solid to yourselves. We are vapory to you, but solid to ourselves. So that we can both claim a share in the use of the word material in reference to our respective existences, your temporary one, and our permanent one. And if I might be allowed to voice a preference, I prefer the permanent one. I have yet to meet anyone who wishes he was back again upon the old earth. Hundreds of years of orthodox religious teachings have implanted totally erroneous notions in the minds of incarnate men concerning the life after death. What information does the Church possess about the spirit world? None. Its bolder members try their hand at speculation, but the fruits of their cogitations amount to precious little. Death of the physical body has itself been made into a grim ogre by the thought of the great unknown that is to follow it. A dreadful journey, it is always deemed, has to be undertaken. Artists and writers alike have combined to make the whole performance shocking, a horrifying business, whose outcome is unpredictable. Death, judgment, heaven or hell, says the Church. That is the prospect before every soul. The first two are certain. There is no possibility of avoiding them. The next two, heaven or hell, it rests with man which he will choose. So proclaims the Church. Life on earth is spent with that one dismal and awful end in view. Some folk elect to ignore the whole thing, preferring to wait with complete indifference, so they aver, for whatever may betide. Whether they actually do or not is a matter upon which some of us here could throw a little light. Others are so haunted by the thought of their last day on earth as to make their lives a misery to them. Others, again, have wrapped the spirit world in so many mysteries and strange beliefs as to make it a place hardly worth coming to, if it could be avoided, by virtue of the fact that those same beliefs have made of it the abode of mystic cranks. They would have you believe that life here is one continual struggle of the soul to do something or other. It is never clearly defined precisely what, by the achievement of this intangible something, or by the imposition of remarkable but inexplicable tests, the soul is urged, while in the meantime, the victim is witnessing a variety of the oddest symbology that could find no place in the scheme of things here. That is dreadfully vague, but then so are the original concepts. Eastern religions have contributed much to the formulation of a multitude of fantastic ideas relative to these beautiful lands in which I live. Such notions may suit the Eastern mind, but they do not bear transplanting into other climes. The spirit world is a practical world, and its methods are businesslike. Why should they not be? The Earth people pride themselves upon such methods because it makes for efficiency. We, too, are efficient, highly efficient, far more so than you can ever be on Earth, because we have far less restrictions both of body and mind. Our restrictions, if one can truthfully so designate them, simply mean that we obey the natural laws of these lands. They are not legal enactments imposed by the will of man. I have witnessed the arrival in these lands of people whose numbers I cannot count, comprising folk from every walk of terrestrial life. I have witnessed the wide variety of emotions which they have exhibited upon the realization of what has taken place in their lives. But never have I come across a soul who wished to go immediately into deep learned discourses about the soul, what it is, and how it functions. Distress of mind, sorrow and anguish, remorse, the commonplace mental disturbances consequent upon seeing the truth at last, will naturally have their effect upon the new arrival. But we rigidly debar anything that is not severely practical in our service to such folk. Where possible, we calm the mind through the eye, by showing them the kind of place to which they have come. That usually answers the purpose. There is more to be learnt in the sight of a magnificent landscape than in 100 homilies upon obscure mental processes as they are supposed to exist in the spirit world. That is part of our service, such service as the Catechism fails to mention. That small volume would lead you to infer that you are left to look after yourself on arrival here, except you be bound for the highest heaven among the angels and saints, where doubtless a reception committee would have everything properly in hand to welcome you, and add your name to the roll of the elect. You would, of course, need nothing else. No service of any sort. In a short space of time, you would have left all your natural and customary environment amid your relatives and friends, left your earthly pursuits, and with the utmost precipitation landed among an enormous company of rarefied beings, and feeling yourself just like a fish out of water. You would do nothing because there is nothing to do, and your earthly spiritual mentors would say that you are in eternal bliss with everlasting happiness. Most likely you would feel thoroughly wretched, and question the happiness. And you would be right. It is easy for some minds to decide wherein another's happiness shall rest. It is usually based upon their own predilections or tastes. Even we, in this land of clear perceptions, are not presumptuous enough to declare to folk what shall be their happiness. If we know their likes and wishes, we can guide and advise them in what manner they can be indulged, and thus they can attain their own true happiness. But in no case are we deciding for them or pronouncing upon what shall be their happiness. It is said this world of the spirit is governed by thought, that thought is paramount. It is sometimes called a thought world. Remembering how impalpable thought may seem to be, folk have not unnaturally believed us to be living in something akin to a dream state, where nothing is concrete, and which, as likely as not, is liable to fade into nothingness just as earthly dreams dissolve. All other things are consonant with that conception. We are shades. Shades, indeed. Such people do not realize that it is they who are the weaker, for their thoughts have no power in our creative sense on Earth until they are translated into material form. With us, our thoughts produce an immediate effect, for we have no earthly state to interpose itself between our thought and its direct action. When we build more solidly than you can ever hope to do on Earth, and permanently. We have no tedious and protracted processes to undertake before our thoughts can have their full realization. I need not point to the immense shortages of necessary things from which you are suffering at this moment throughout so wide an area of the earth plane. Such a condition could not exist here. Our building material for everything is thought, a never-failing substance which is durable and imperishable, until we have no further use for whatever it is we have created. We use our thoughts in service because, once again, there is no intervening earthly state to prevent their quick and direct action. No, we are not shadows, wandering about in a wispy sort of way with nothing to do. We are intensely active, using our minds, producing concrete results in the service of our fellows. We do not have unbearable delays brought about by the petty minds of the inefficient. Nor do we have cranks trying to impose their wild, fallacious ideas upon us. That is not service as we know it. Our work goes on because there is nothing to hinder its progress. We have no quarrels or disputes. We have no stoppages. And well for the people of Earth it undoubtedly is that we do not, for their influence would be felt at once. We have no need here to belong to societies to secure our rights, or to redress our wrongs. Societies of that kind, in fact, do not exist. We depend upon each other as do you. Did you but realize it fully? With us, service does not mean an eternal round of distasteful and laborious tasks. What we do willingly because we have chosen that particular form of work. We do the work that suits us, for which we have a natural aptitude or talent, the work that brings us the greatest satisfaction, work, moreover, which will produce the best results proportionate to our labor, and which will bring the greatest benefit to others, either directly or indirectly. No possible service is lost or overlooked or unheeded, or too insignificant to be considered. No matter how small the service may be, it will add to the sum of our spiritual progression without fail. We have no cause to remind anyone of what we have done. Although there is no such mysterious personage as a recording angel, yet, somewhere or somehow, our services are converted into the substance of spiritual advancement. We do not pause to ponder how our progression comes about, we are too overjoyed in the reality of it to bother our heads over subjects which it is problematical whether we should understand in the present state of our knowledge. How many times during the course of your day do you perform some small action for another whose need of help is not actually pressing, but who requires some trivial assistance? You give it, and pass on, and the whole incident has passed from your mind in the space of seconds. You would, in any case, treat it as a commonplace of your natural existence. Reward? Of course not. You do not expect rewards for just directing a fellow passenger to the road for which he is searching. In any case, who is to reward you for such a paltry service? Who, indeed, on Earth? Service, my friends, is not confined to either world alone. Though you may have in mind financial payment for services when I mention the word to you, yet there is much that is performed and passed by where money never enters into the transaction. To put the truth for you in a few words, service that is performed for a fellow being with no other intention than that of helping him or of bringing him some good is the substance of which spiritual progression is composed. That is not to say that all service done for monetary considerations is itself without other reward. Bethink you of the numerous occasions during your life on earth when some small addition, in help or advice, say, to that which you have bought and paid for, is freely tendered. All part of the general commercial system, you will say, just good business, that is all. It may be good business, but you reap the benefit. What is most important, the person who extends the kindness reaps the spiritual benefit in service freely given, and both parties will be that much the better. Service need not be counted in money. Man upon earth hardly realizes the interdependence that is the very basis of terrestrial life. It is when a great stoppage occurs in vital services, and people are thrown upon their own resources or must perforce go in want, that the fact of man being dependent upon his fellows is fully comprehended. Man is far more dependent upon his neighbor now than he was hundreds of years ago. Life has since become immensely more complicated and involved. The machinery of earthly existence is so complex and interrelated that when one comparatively small section of it ceases to function, whatever the causes may be, the whole is almost bound to be affected in some measure, great or small. The economic machinery of the spirit world is always in operation. It never pauses for the fraction of a moment. There is nothing, no possible combination of circumstances that are ever likely to arise that could lessen or stop the service that is going on continuously. We have our own world to look after, and we have yours as well. With the huge strains that were put upon the spirit world during the recent earthly cataclysm, there was no failure in the services, no breakdown. You cannot wage fierce and devastating war upon earth without its effect being transmitted into spirit lands. In many respects our work was far greater than yours. For you were concerned with one world, your own, but we were concerned with two, ours and yours. Our work employed vast numbers in its execution. You will, I have no doubt, recall the old saying about counting your blessings. No advice could be more sound and beneficial. As a corollary to it, I would like to suggest that during the course of one day you count also the various services that have been rendered to you. You would be appreciably surprised, I am persuaded. Whither is all this leading, you may be tempted to inquire. In several directions. I am anxious to show you that in the spirit world work means service, and not just toil. For work has something of a harsh sound, honest though the term may be. After a life of work on earth, to lay stress upon still more work after you have left the earth at your dissolution may fill you with feelings of disappointment, or perhaps of plain revulsion. We do not toil in these lands. Banish from your minds all ideas of physical fatigue, all monotony, all the hazards of time and circumstances, consequent upon mundane work. How very precarious can be life upon earth has been evidenced so shockingly of late when the whole earth has been turned upside down, and lives torn asunder, figuratively speaking, by the upheaval. How are you to know that it will not all happen again with even more hideous intensification? Is your life on earth so certain? Indeed, it is not. But of that we will speak again later when I hope to gather together a few threads of thought for your consideration. The most important point of our discussion is one that is apparent to be overlooked. It is this, that man upon earth is not really the dreadful sinner which religion in general would have him to be. There are certain well-established exceptions which it would be needless for me to mention to you. They concern a specific region of the earth, and it is understood that I am now speaking of my friends of earth and their friends, and so on. Man is always understood to have sinned against God pretty well from the beginning, and to have kept up his sinning ever since with varying degrees of intensity. Major wars, plagues, famines, floods and other meteorological disturbances are all sent, so you are taught, by a God who has been so continuously provoked that at last it was imperative that he should retaliate to bring mankind to his senses for the good of his immortal soul. He does so, as it is alleged, by inflicting great punishment upon the people of earth through sufferings of body or mind, or both. That belief is utterly and completely erroneous. God punishes no man. Man, however, can punish himself and does so very capably. The Church teaches that man is a miserable sinner, and the prayer books provide documentary evidence in full measure that he is so. Some will believe it, others will not. And more again will not care one way or the other. But the Church never takes into account because it cannot possibly know, that serving God does not merely consist of assembling people in large numbers in some impressive ceremony of prayer and praise upon one day of the week or another. Service to God means service to man. How else to serve Him? In elaborate religious ceremonials before large congregations, with the officiating clergy attired in full canonicals, and with the choir straining themselves in highly involved music, with eloquent sermons, and long ornate processions? On with the utmost simplicity of ritual, in fact, no ritual whatever, but with inordinate psalm and hymn singing? Does God demand, or need, on wish for either or both of these extremes?